You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo again today as my co-host, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, will not be with us. But remember, each week, one or both of us will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. You know, having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is young adults in treatment. And with me to discuss this is Douglas Bowden. Douglas is the CEO and co-founder of the Bowden Group. Now, since 1993, Douglas has worked with more than 2,000 children, adolescents, and young adults in a variety of educational and treatment settings. More currently, he has also developed considerable expertise coaching adults and families. In addition to that, his expertise really goes into a lot of other areas, one of which is working with the legal system toward alternatives to sentencing for juvenile and young adult offenders and integration of therapeutic outdoor experience programs in the intervention process. Now, Douglas is also the architect of the unique team approach that Bowden brings to its cases and developed the visionary integration approach to serving clients that it is sort of the model for the industry. Now, he is also the recipient of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs 2009, the Essential Peace Award for Outstanding Service, educating members of Congress and the Senate about this industry. He holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Douglas, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks, Alan. Good morning.
Well, good morning. This is a very interesting topic, and I went online to sort of start looking at some of the other information that's out there, because I know sometimes parents, when they're trying to figure out what to do, they really don't know where to go, and unfortunately, sometimes they just go to the internet and see what they can find. Now, having talked with you a little bit on this subject, you've said that the success rate for short-term rehab hovers around 8%. Now, looking on the internet, I noticed that there are some numbers that are similar to that. Why do you think that is, that this percentage is so low, and yet there's still so many programs out there?
Well, I think that's one of the big topics that I'm here to address. I think there are many causes of that. The duration of many of the rehabs is problematic. 28 days is just too short. 30 days, of course, too short. And then you get into programs that are 90 days, and that's where you start to see some decent success rates. That's what studies, for example, out of the Betty Ford Center have shown. I think a major cause, however, is, and I'm speaking specifically about the young adult population here, that a foundation has not been set by the parents that are typically paying for these stints. The young people themselves are not independent or autonomous, and therefore the codependency of the family continues past the rehab. I believe that the short-term treatment, it's a Hail Mary of sorts when parents become desperate and want to see something that's going to work, and so spending money on something short seems like the culturally acceptable answer these days.
Now, you mentioned codependency. Can you give us an example of what codependency looks like in these situations for maybe some of those parents who really don't know what to look for?
Well, I'll give you a little story. We had a family of a young woman who was 22. She was at a university bombing out into opiates and found a nearby, very expensive 30-day rehab and had asked her parents to fund it. And she wanted to be close to her boyfriend and wanted to go right back to her college setting, believing that a rehab would do something for her. The dad in that case was all too willing to do it, as he had earlier bought her a large screen TV for her dorm with the expectation that that would solve her problem. Her claim was she wouldn't have to go out of her dorm to seek her friends if she had a nice TV to stay in. So that was a codependent act of desperation on the dad's part in that scenario. And the rehab stint was a very similar endeavor. And it, too, did not work, obviously.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, that she was kind of pulling the string. She wanted it close to her college. She wanted it close to her boyfriend. As soon as you said that, the first question that popped in my mind was, did the parents really look to this and see, is the boyfriend supportive of this? Because if he's not supportive of it, making her close to him seems ridiculous.
Well, of course it's ridiculous. But, and yes, he was also a user, not necessarily to the same extent. He was encouraging her to go to rehab as well. But he was obviously part of the problem. And the dad in this scenario, out of a desperation, truly a sincere love of his daughter, was fearful that if he did not act on her demand for rehab, things would get worse, but also hopeful that something quick and that claimed such wonderful things about itself, the rehab, that it would work. So that scenario illustrates how oftentimes the notion of rehab can prey on the parents' hopes and fears, which are the underlying pillars that support codependency.
Well, and taking the story you just gave us, what's the rest of the story in regards to that? Did the parents ever get to a point to realize that they had to take a different approach?
The rest of the story, and part of my frustration that led me to this conversation, Alan, they came to me after this failed attempt, actually several failed attempts, and they were in my office, again, desperate for help, but out of money.
Oh.
And so they had burned through literally hundreds of thousands of dollars and were still right back in the same place and still very codependent. And no one had ever along the way let the parents know that they're continuing to feed the money, the Safeway cards that she was using to sell them and get drugs herself, that they're feeding her the money was codependent, and that had to stop, that there needed to be a bottom line, that they would no longer support, contribute to her self-destruction in a financial or any other way. It doesn't mean don't love your daughter anymore. Mm-hmm. It just means if you're going to do treatment, it also has to be with the expectation that we will not be going back to business as usual in funding your self-destruction. And no parent wants to see it that way, of course, but ultimately that's what's happening.
Now, you mentioned hundreds of thousands of dollars. How many rehabs did this young person go through before the parents were out of money and came to you?
About four, I believe.
Okay. And I know you've used the term revolving door. I mean, at that point, I mean, what can be done up front to stop that cycle, again, what you call the revolving door of rehab?
I think the parents need to be clear, first of all, about how their hopes, they need to understand, be educated, how their hopes and their fears are being exploited, often by their adult child. So they start to recognize their codependent dynamic, and then make a very clear offer of help, but a very clear declaration at the same time that this will be the end of them supporting a self-destructive lifestyle. And they have to be what I call unconditionally done with that codependent dynamic before any type of treatment is likely to be effective for a young adult. And the reason I say unconditionally, Alan, is because a lot of times families will say, well, we just want our daughter to be happy. We just want her to be successful. Well, we can't control that. We can control our offers to our children, offer you this help in this healthy, constructive way, but we also can control only our boundaries. We will not continue to support your apartment or your car, which you use to get to the bars, whatever it is, that support, the underwriting of the self-destructive lifestyle has to come to an end. It needs to be clear and credible and consistently delivered.
Well, this sounds like a pattern that I think we've both seen many times. And, I mean, is this the pattern where the parent has started at an early age feeling like they need to be their child's best friend rather than their parent?
I think that's one scenario, but I think it also comes from the fact that we as parents of younger children have to support and have to protect our children. And even parents who are model parents, quote-unquote, up until they find themselves with a child as an adult who is in a self-destructive pattern. And I don't think it's universally the case that the parents have been trying to be their child's friend. I think it gets confusing because there's not a lot of people telling them the very tough things they need to hear about holding that boundary in the face of your child's distress. And this is where a parent's well-intentioned hope that by supporting another scheme to go to junior college and get a job, or the fear that if they don't support that scheme, the child will slip ever deeper into the self-destruction, prostitution, drug dealing, and all of the rest of the catastrophizing that is a natural part of that codependent dynamic.
Well, now, as we're talking about as far as the codependency, I was discussing this upcoming show over the weekend with someone that had gotten one of our emails, and they said they actually thought that the rehab business was getting better because they were seeing so much media attention where top celebrities are going in and they're seeing results. I mean, how is that affecting some of these parents' decision as far as top celebrities being involved and there being this much attention?
You know, I don't follow the celebrities too closely, Alan. I'm failing to come up with the name of someone who's been successful. I think more often what we hear are those that are emblematic of this revolving door, the Lindsay Lohans, the Charlie Sheens, et cetera. And I think it's also difficult to compare because these are people with their own financial means. When I'm talking about the young adults, I'm talking about people who don't have their own financial means. I'm talking about people who are still dependent on their parents, and parents therefore still have some traction, some influence on what a child does, where a child goes. And I can't speak to having seen them get better as a result of the celebrities. To me, what's happened is it has established this notion of rehab as the thing to do, when in fact it doesn't address some of these bottom line factors that parents need to understand to support effective treatment of any kind.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you bring up a great point is, you know, whatever we see from the standpoint of the celebrities, if they're A, funding their own their own rehab, and B, you know, in many of them, it might be their second, third, or fourth, fifth time. I mean, it's great when they can, you know, like a Robert Downey Jr. that celebrates the fact that, you know, that he has come through this. Sometimes they forget the failures that he had however many times prior to coming out successful.
That's correct. And I think if you speak with people who themselves have been successful in rehab and they tell their stories, you often hear multiple attempts, parents who've gone bankrupt. And what I often hear is that if they are successful through that revolving door, it was that last one where their children were being taken away by the state and they were sent to a very, actually, low-end, very modest, not the high-end places. When I talk with people, it's when their parents have, for the sixth time, sent them to treatment, but it was at the local county-run facility where they were sleeping on a cot that actually got their attention.
Right. So what you're saying is sometimes it isn't the high-profile, very luxurious place that works for every child. It may be something that really is more of a recognizing that you've hit bottom type of program?
I think that's an essential component of it, is hitting bottom. And some of these places that I've seen with expensive linens and a chef and beautiful, serene views, they're nice. They're nicer than my home in many cases. And I have a hard time seeing that as being a bottom. And I don't want to take away from the many tragic stories of people who have gone to these places and actually worked hard, because those stories exist too. But I think that the illusion that is sold to parents, that that is going to be an effective, quick, comfortable, easy fix, is what I'm mostly addressing today.
Yeah, we have an email coming across that touches, I think, on this very subject. This one reads, at the age of 20, I checked myself into an alcohol rehab program. This was 10 years ago. The first 2 weeks were a horrible adjustment. The last 3 weeks were a feel-good bonding experience with other attendees. 6 months after leaving the program, I was back drinking. It says, it was not until my fiance, parents, and sister all intervened as a unit that I found life-changing help. It says, we all committed to joining our respective AA groups. It was my family support that allowed me to implement change and led to my completing my college degree and starting a family. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a great story, and there's some missing pieces of information there, but I imagine that those family members were not only supportive by going to their respective AA meetings and probably Al-Anon meetings as well, but were also giving her a bottom line, that they would not continue to indulge her in whatever way they may have been. The fiancé may have been threatening to call off the marriage should she not get help. So there are some bottom line boundaries that were being set, I imagine and I hope, and I think that, frankly, are essential if any treatment is likely to be effective.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading that, actually I thought of a story on a case that I was involved in. And in this situation, the young man had not only been to rehab four different times, but had also been in jail on three different occasions as well for some drug and alcohol issues. And the really sad part, what appeared to be sad in the beginning, was they asked me to pick him up when he was being released from jail. And they asked if I would take him to Hawaii. And they said, we would like you to take him there, because every time he gets out of jail or gets out of rehab, he has not only relapsed, but he comes back and he steals from the family. And they would like him to be to where he could not easily show up at their doorstep while they're not home. And they felt that was really the only way for them to, you know, a tough love type of thing. Until he could actually clean up. Now, again, it was sad from the standpoint that they had gotten to that point, but the good news to it was that they told me later they were contacted by him, and he had checked himself into a program in Hawaii, and about a year later, was able to become part of the family again, once they were sure that this time it was a program that really did take effect for him.
Well, and a year is much more the duration we like to see in treatment for young people, because
right.
They need to be somewhere where they can learn healthy coping mechanisms, life skills, have the substances out of their system long enough for their brains to rewire, create new habits, create a cohort that is also committed to recovery and a healthy lifestyle. So I'm imagining those are some factors that contributed to this young man's success.
Yeah, and share with us what your opinion is of the length of stay that really is going to be able to take effect. Because I know that, you know, there's a wide spectrum of what we see that is supposed to be a reasonable stay.
Well, I think we're talking about a stay somewhere. So first of all, I think that parents will often ask me, how long does my child need to be away from drugs? And I'll say, well, for the foreseeable future, forever. This is a lifetime commitment. So that's one component of it. There, a lot of times young people will commit to, I'll be sober for a month, or I'll just do marijuana, or I will commit to 6 months. And, you know, we're not going to push it on them right away, but the parents need to be educated that this is really ultimately a lifetime of prioritizing their sobriety over all else in their and their child's decision-making, that all decisions must be made with that as the number one priority. Now, in terms of length of stay in programs, if something short-term or primary is going to happen as a first step, and there's going to be a longer independent living program for young adults where they can start to develop these skills and tools with real adult guidance and support and ongoing therapy. I think a year is at least a good general marker for how long this needs to go on. Some of the new breed of SLEs that exists, you know, that where they're really understanding that developmentally the young adults need something very different than a 50-year-old executive.
Right, and I want to highlight something that you said to make sure that everybody out there got it, is this 1 year doesn't necessarily need to be all in one program as long as the plan is to go from one program that focuses on one area and shifts directly into another that helps support them for a greater length of time. Is that correct?
That's correct, because the isolation of a first or primary step isn't the real world, and ultimately they need to have real-world experiences. And by the way, out of the familiar territory of their hometown, their home triggers and affiliations that have been part of that self-destructive lifestyle. So yes, longer and farther away.
Right, and that flies right into your first story of letting the girl control the fact that it'll be close to her school, close to her friends, close to her boyfriend. It sounds like that was destined to fail right from the start.
Well, just as I talked about the parents needing to be unconditionally done being codependent, so too does the individual ultimately need to be unconditionally ready to get sober. And what that girl was doing was putting a number of conditions upon how she was going to go through treatment.
Now, in talking about short and long term, let's also address outdoor versus indoor. Share with us a little bit on your thoughts in that area.
Well, as you know, Alan, I'm a big fan of outdoor therapeutic programs as a first step, especially for this age group. And that's because a lot of times when they've reached 24 or so and they've had failure after failure after failure and no real successes in their life, what they need, I believe, is the hard work, the effort, the perseverance necessary in an outdoor setting just to get through the day, to have those successes on a daily basis in a concrete manner, starts to build a foundational level of self-esteem, self-confidence, the ability to meet real challenges physically and emotionally and to overcome them. And I feel that in indoor settings where all of your basic needs are being met, in fact, oftentimes at a quite luxurious, if not indulgent level, really runs counter to what we're trying to do with young people, which is to get them built up, strengthened, not just continuing to indulge them.
Now, and what would you say to the parent that maybe they've raised their children in a very indulgent suburban area where everything has been given to them, or even a big city area like, you know, somebody raised in New York? I've spoken with some of the parents, you know, when they've started, you know, when we're going to transport somebody to a wilderness program, and they go, I cannot imagine my child, who has never even, you know, spent more than 2 hours in Central Park, being able to spend, you know, 8 or 10 weeks out in the wilderness.
All the more that achievement, that accomplishment comes through as a major success going forward. So we all know they can do it physically. Is that they haven't had to do it. But no program is going to challenge them beyond what they're actually physically capable of. And when that young person finds they really can do these things, it will be all the more powerful an experience because they've overcome something that no one thought they really could do. And that's metaphorically what they're trying to do with regard to their substance abuse and other self-destructive lifestyles.
I think that's very well put. And I can also attest to that from the standpoint of picking up some of those young people and taking them from that first step on to the next step and seeing a difference in their eyes, seeing the life in their eyes. And at times, and I think anybody that has worked around people who are dealing with some form of addiction and have for some time, they get this sort of a dead eyes. And when you're looking into those dead eyes, you know, it's very sad. But seeing them when they are coming out of a wilderness program and seeing their eyes alive where they feel they've had this great sense of achievement, I think that really it speaks volumes and to exactly what it is you're saying.
I can give you a couple of other scenarios, Alan.
Please do.
In talking with people who run the the new breed of SLE and the independent living programs, they will tell you unequivocally that there is a night and day difference between those coming from indoor programs versus outdoor programs. And when I've had clients who themselves have been through, let's say, a couple of short-term rehabs and then go into wilderness, they will tell me what a substantial difference it is. They will tell me routinely how different the experience is for themselves and how much more they get out of it, how much more insight, how much more appreciation for not only what they do have in life, but for the things that people around them have done for them to get them to this point in a healthy way. So the wilderness is really a metaphor. It's really this very boiled down, interdependent group of people operating out there. So one's patterns of operating in the world, or their avoidance mechanisms, or the manipulations, are being witnessed in very real, concrete ways all day, every day, by their cohort, and being reflected back upon them. And that metaphor is what ultimately sinks in so powerfully for young people.
Well, I think that's great. And actually, we have another listener question, or actually comment, coming in. This one reads, it says, I am an educational consultant specializing in college placement. When I saw this topic pop up on Alan's press release, I just had to make a comment. We estimate that 5% of these young people that we place have either drug or behavioral issues. Regardless of how carefully we screen schools, all too often the young person flunks out and ends up exactly as you described, placed in the revolving door of the rehab system. It is time our industry acknowledged this problem. Thank you for being of the first I have seen with the courage to speak out about this.
That's very well said. I think that we're all seeing it, and it's this very large, profitable industry. And the parents that come to us, we're the professionals who are responsible for guiding these families, not just continuing to sell a false hope. I think it's a huge responsibility.
Well, and share with some of our listeners, because again, our listeners predominantly, I think, are made up of parents, but we have a lot of professionals as well. Explain about what an educational consultant does, and that this one we just spoke of says they specialize in college placement. Explain the difference between that and someone who specializes in what's called special needs.
Well, unfortunately, there's a wide variety of how educational consultants or treatment consultants operate and what their backgrounds may be. This woman, it sounds like, works primarily with college placement issues. Practices like ours deal more prominently with children, adolescents, and young adults who aren't thriving for whatever combination of reasons. And so it's our job as a team to be constantly staying familiar with a wide range of treatment approaches, treatment environments, programs, therapeutic boarding schools, et cetera. And in our view, to not only become educated about the individual and the family's needs and the family system and how it operates so that we can help address the entire system, but really to educate the families themselves about what's likely to be effective, what's likely to work specific to their situation, because sometimes these stories can all sound the same. And ultimately, the origins of the issues, the family systems, are all different from one another. They're all unique. We have to be very much attuned to that and educate the family so that they can be decision makers who are able to remain committed to a course of action, because it's not going to be a short, quick, easy fix. And if all they have is the internet, or all they have is this cultural notion that rehab is what you do, they've been misled. And they haven't been well prepared for what they need to do. So our practice as educational and therapeutic consultants also means really coaching the parents about how to do treatment well.
That sounds great. It sounds like it's covering all the bases. We are talking with Douglas Bowden. He is the CEO of the Bowden Group, and we are talking about young adults and really young people in treatment. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult,
We are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We are talking with Douglas Bowden, and I want to touch on a little bit more about educational consultants. And I was thinking about it while we were listening to, we had the commercial in the background, and one of the things that we mentioned in there is saying that we have people like Douglas that we would refer you to, and we get, and a lot of you parents will listen to a show like this, and you will send us an email. We get quite a few of them after each show that says things like, you know, that sounds great, you know, can you send my child to one of those programs? We did something recently for the Dr. Phil show, and we got over 100 calls and or emails that came in, some of which just said, can you come get my child? And I took some of these calls, and I said, well, what program are you having them taken to? And they said, I don't care. Just come get them, because my child is just like that one that you guys took to a program. So I want to take this time to explain, you know, well, first of all, with each one of those, I mean, we try to get the information, you know, from them where they're at geographically, and we try and get them to an ed consultant in that area. And the reason is just as Douglas is explaining right now, they are specializing in being able to work with the whole family. So, you know, for us to at that point in time say, yeah, we'll just go here, we have no idea what's going on with your child. So understand that this is such an important step, and especially while we're talking about, treatment programs, and in this case, drug rehab programs for young adults. Some of the reasons why many of the statistics that you will find say that there is a lot of people that have to now go back to the same program or go to another program afterwards, and it may very well be because you've not really gone to somebody who's checked out the whole family dynamic. Now, Doug, I mean, what would you like to add to that? I mean, does that kind of make sense in regards to what we're saying?
Well, what it does is it speaks to what I call the commoditization of treatment. That is, just go to any rehab, go here, go there, go to this wilderness, go to that wilderness, and it really loses sight of the individualization that is necessary in tailoring a plan that gets very meticulous about the needs of that child or the young adult child and of the family. Because if those myriad details aren't well attended to, you really are just turning treatment into a commodity. It might as well. They're interchangeable at that point. So I think that your comments illustrate that quite well.
Right. And one of the examples that I give is, and I'll explain to somebody and say, if you were told that your child needed brain surgery and I'm the ambulance driver and I drive up, would you ask the ambulance driver, can you give me some input in regards to, should I go to this hospital or should I go to that hospital or should I use this doctor or should use that, you know, use that doctor? And, you know, what additional information can you tell me in regards to the brain surgery? It's like, I don't think you'd ask your ambulance driver for that information, you know? So,
well, I think you sell yourself short in that regard, Alan, but to take that analogy, if you're going to have someone in an ambulance who needs brain surgery, but you take them to an orthopedic surgeon, you've gone to the wrong place.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Based on all of this information, and I know that when we had talked before, you had talked a little bit about sort of going into something that is more of a slow motion, relation. what would be sort of a slow motion relation or a slow motion intervention that you think would work better in these situations?
Well, I think the type of intervention, again, needs to be tailored to the specific needs. There are times where we don't have time for what I call a slow motion relational intervention, which I'll explain in a moment. There are situations that are so dire that we have to have something in place within days or even hours. That happens, and that kind of intervention for a young person, I think, looks different than what we often see on TV. The parents do have a lot of influence and control and traction in those situations. If they're willing to use it, they have all the financial purse strings. The slow motion relational intervention, if we don't have extreme safety risks, takes the time to really prepare the parents in the ways I'm talking about today, regarding their own codependency, regarding their boundaries, about being unconditionally done. And it can take families days, weeks, or even months to come to that position where they're ready to invest in a treatment plan because they've come to the realization that their support, their conditional doneness is not being effective. It may need to be that they're trying a few other things locally before they're really for the investment of inpatient treatment of some sort.
Now, go ahead.
I was going to say the relational piece often is that ultimately the young people are invited to participate in the process of the parents getting their coaching and for them to participate in becoming educated as well, even having some ownership, therefore investment, in where they might go. If they can trust us as the consultants and they can start to trust that the parents' mode of operating is also changing and that they're going to have to take some very different action. Maybe they don't like it very much, but they come to realize that their parents have become credible in that their codependent dynamic has come to an end.
Now, how often in those short-term crisis situations is the information that you then get from the wilderness program, like a short-term wilderness program, how often is that information just really, really vital to making the decision for the longer-term placement?
100%. I think that one of the most valuable pieces of a primary program of any sort, especially wilderness, is in the evaluative feedback that comes to us as the planners with the family. So in our situation, I can't speak for all consultants, so I think many operate this way as well. We're on the phone calls every week with the wilderness therapist and the parents, hearing for an hour about the child's week, their strengths, their challenges, their accomplishments, their insights. And ultimately, a good wilderness therapist is also going to be providing information about what that young person is going to need going forward, therapeutically, from a recovery standpoint, educationally, and with the young adults specifically, we're going to include them in that decision-making as well. Not necessarily with veto power or they get to say exactly where they get to go, but oftentimes they get some choice once the parents have vetted some good, appropriate options, even talking with young people by phone or even meeting them in the field, where, again, they have that ownership. A lot of times these young people feel like their parents have been making all the decisions for them in their lives. So we want to give them some ownership and investment. So as the parents are making the offer of ongoing assistance in an independent living program, for example, there's also the credible boundary that they will not be funding something that goes back to being unhealthy and self-destructive.
Now, let me ask you about one of the things that has been a huge issue for me, and I know that it's gotten much better over the years, but again, having seen this for 30 years, what about the aftercare? And I know that, I mean, 30 years ago when I started getting involved in this, one of my biggest frustrations were the fact that so many people would go to these programs, they would come out, and there really wasn't an aftercare plan set up. And then everybody would go right back to what they did before, both the child that may have gone to the program and the parents in the way in which they were handling things.
Agreed. Even if we go somewhere for a couple of places and it's a year in duration, I don't think we as an industry, consultants, programs, therapists, do a good enough job of the aftercare. And it's understandable. If the young person is successful, which they typically are in this kind of a plan, and the parents are burnt out and exhausted, financially drained, there's a strong likelihood of going back to where the inertia was before. So we have to prepare and plan for that in advance And as an industry, I think we all need to do a better job of being very clear that this isn't done, that some real important decisions around what the parents will be supporting or not supporting are going to be vital to the long-term success for that individual.
Okay, and what would be the single most important thing you would tell the parents so that they don't fall into that that sort of backslide situation?
Boy, the single most important one, I say we have to keep our foot on the gas. I say we have to, and we're talking primarily about substance abuse today, Alan, so
yeah.
In those cases, I think making all decisions, even in the aftercare mode, that prioritize the recovery, sobriety is the number one element. So what does that mean in terms of what that individual needs in their life and their lifestyle to be successful or not? And that's an important concept. This is important in that we coach parents to let go of the outcome. We can offer gold standard of treatment specifically tailored to your young adult child's needs. And guess what? They still may fail. And counterintuitively, it's the acceptance of that notion of letting go of the outcome and not trying to control what they do or whether they're happy that is another necessary precondition for a successful outcome. It's counterintuitive, but it's important. Let go of the outcome.
I think that makes perfect sense. Now, we have another sort of phenomenon that is been occurring lately. We're dealing with more and more situations in which, as we're talking to a family and we're discussing what the drug addiction issues are, I've had multiple cases recently in which they've said, well, our concern is that our child is drinking and that they're taking a particular drug, a street drug. And then as we find out more and they go, But we did go and get them a prescription for medical marijuana, and we're accepting of that. What do you tell a parent when you have, on the one hand, they're concerned about one thing, and yet they think the other is completely okay?
How much longer do we have here, Ellen?
We've got about 8 minutes.
This is a whole other show. You know, here's the problem. Marijuana has become evangelized by young people and by the medicinal crowd. And I think there are legitimate uses for marijuana, and I think we need to have better studies that show it. On the other hand, what that evangelism does is it continues the mythology that marijuana can't be just as destructive as any other substance. Maybe it's not as physically addictive. Maybe it won't cause you to lose your teeth. But marijuana has destroyed many, many lives. And all of us, you, me, and the other educational consultants and therapists have seen so many cases of kids who have become non-functional because of just marijuana. And so there has to be a more honest and open conversation on both sides. The medicinal marijuana crowd needs to recognize, understand, and accept the fact that it has destroyed many lives. It has sapped their motivation, their development of executive functioning capabilities can deteriorate. And at the same time, there are some legitimate uses for marijuana. So just as we accept that there's a legitimate place for the drinking of alcohol for some people who can handle it, so too is there a legitimate use for marijuana in limited cases where it's effective medicinally, but it also has destructive effects as well.
Right. And I think another thing to add for any of the parents out there that have found themselves in this situation or thinking about a decision as it relates to medical marijuana is that for those people that are maybe in my age group, okay, in the 50-year-olds and such, well, when you were 18 years old, marijuana was a completely different animal. It was a completely different strength. And now there are so many tests out that show that the kids today that may be using marijuana now are using something that is 5 to 10 times stronger than what you as a teenager may have smoked, 30 or 40 years ago. So I think that's another thing that a lot of the parents don't recognize and then don't understand when their children respond differently than maybe they remember themselves responding to it when they experimented with it.
Absolutely. And so not only is it a different drug, far more potent now than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's in a different place in the culture than it was 30, 40 years ago. And I use the word evangelist quite deliberately, because young people, I think boys especially, become so enamored, so in love with the substance in a way that we don't see for any other substance, really. There's a love-hate relationship between a user and just about every other substance that I can think of, whereas there's really a love-love relationship with marijuana. And parents don't understand, of this generation, don't understand how much the culture has evangelized the use of marijuana for these young people.
And what would be some of the things that maybe some of the parents should be watching out for if they're listening and going, well, I don't think my child's smoking marijuana, but, well, their grades have dropped from A's to D's, and
right.
and they've got, you know, 17 pizza boxes under their bed. What are some of the things that you think that they can be looking out for to maybe go, you know, maybe I better get my child tested?
Well, and we'll talk about testing in a moment too, Alan, but I think that because you don't have to smoke anywhere near as much marijuana, parents will say, well, I never smell smoke on him. Well, it can be one hit is all it takes. And marijuana comes in so many different forms, from lollipops to ice cream, cookies, that you won't necessarily smell any smoke. But the erratic behavior, the mood swings, the drop in grades, the changes in friends, the isolation in their room oftentimes is a part of it. Those are some of the signs. And parents need to be careful with drug tests as well, because a lot of times parents will come in here and say, well, we know he's not smoking marijuana anymore because he's peeing clean. Well, I would encourage any parent who's drug testing their child to go and Google how to fake a drug test and watch how many hundreds of thousands of sites come up that will show you any product or any methodology to get by any test kit or any test protocol. So someone who's really committed to smoking marijuana is committed enough to look on Google and figure it out.
Now,
so testing, let me say one more thing about this, Alan. Testing can lead to complacency. So to your question about what are the signs to look for, parents need to be vigilant with those signs and not become complacent if they're testing.
All right, and it sounds like now would these things that can defeat the testing process, are those things that maybe just work on the things that you buy over the counter, or is this even if you're taking them to your doctor?
Even if you're taking them to your doctor.
Yeah, there you go. You know, we have about 2 minutes left, and I really like to leave people with as many tools as possible. So let me just, if you can give some tips, again, to all the parents out there, if their child is addicted or not, if they're just having some form of trouble, I mean, how can any of these parents really get their children to listen to them more, and to be able to just communicate on a level that maybe makes their life better on both sides, parent and child?
Well, I think sometimes getting the child to listen to the parents more often has to include the parents listening to the child more. And sometimes I think parents are so eager to make the speeches and control their child's behavior, they're not hearing what the child's really looking for, which may be as simple as more positive attention, more positive together time. Even though the child is saying, go away, go away, go away, you know, sometimes that's what a parent needs to do, is give the child some space. And when things really are deteriorating, don't reach out and rush out of desperation to the first thing that comes along or the first thing that you hear about. There are experts in these fields, from the educational consultants, many good psychologists, and you have to listen to them too.
All right. And again, we are talking with Douglas Bowden. We are going to run out of time here shortly. Can you give us a website or phone number that people, if you have additional questions, you can either call this number or go to your website?
Sure. The website address is www.thebowdengroup.com, and the 800 number is 800-874-2124. And be glad to talk to anybody who has any further questions or comments.
All right. And for anybody out there, if you are driving and you cannot write this down, we don't want you to try to. Go ahead. You can go to our website, which is www.answers4thefamilyblog.com, and either submit the question to us or just look on there and you'll be able to click on something that will lead you directly to this site. Douglas, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. I think it's been very enlightening. And again, anybody, if you have questions, give them a call. I know that I've called Doug just to ask questions, and he will be very forthcoming in giving you answers.
Alan, thank you very much.
All right. Everybody, have a great week, and we look forward to you listening to us again next week at this time. Bye now.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.